once again to the psychedelicparenting.org podcast. I am your host, Jonathan. Today I wanted to start off by apologizing for the long gap between this podcast and the last. The holiday season and recovery from it have been a long road for our family, but we're back on the horse and ready to bring you some great conversations. To pay you back for our absence, I am making a promise to send you one podcast a week every Wednesday for the duration of Lent. In the Christian tradition, Lent is a time of sacrifice, prayer, and renewing of spiritual commitments. Along with becoming more charitable and improving my meditation practice, this podcast is a part of the spiritual promise I'm making to the divine and to you, my community, for this season of sacrifice and spiritual growth leading up to Easter. With that in mind, I am still looking for a couple more guests to round out the 40 days. If you have a story to tell, please reach out to me. My email address is psychedelicparenting@gmail.com. Also behind this vow is the inspiration of my friend and podcasting mentor, KMO, who recently celebrated his 500th episode of the Sea Realm podcast. In the many years since starting the Sea Realm, KMO has never missed a single weekly episode. In fact, there were many years when he was doing not only the Sea Realm, but also simultaneously Psychonautica and the Sea Realm Vault podcast. Since he and I met in 2013 at Symposia, KMO has been willing to promote my work and is always free with advice on how to make this podcast better. Congratulations, KMO, and thank you. Your work on the Sea Realm and Psychonautica has been a beacon of consciousness and a testament to your commitment to consistency. Here's to another decade behind the mic. May country life be kind to you and Olga. Before we begin today's show, I would like to thank the folks who have donated to our GoFundMe since the last episode. Thank you to Steve E., Jason B., and Devin L. We would also like to thank the attendees of the Driftless Psychedelic Symposium in Viroqua, Wisconsin, who bought stickers and posters from our table and threw a few dollars in our donation basket. The money they've donated will be used to pay for 4 months of podcast hosting at Podomatic. Thanks for making this happen, Viroqua. Next week, we will be talking with Steve Elfrink, the organizer of this beautiful event. Thank you also to Melvi and Lori P., who rode with us and paid for gas, and to Andrew D., who covered tolls and shared the cost of lodging. You're all the wind beneath our wings, and we are so happy to serve you. For those of you who haven't donated yet, remember that we have an open offer from Robert Barnhart, a member of the board of directors of MAPS and the Hefter Research Institute, and the producer of the film A New Understanding, The Science of Psilocybin. Robert has an open offer for an up to $2,000 matching gift, and we thank him for his generous assistance. We have also become a fiscal sponsorship of MAPS, and a tax-deductible donation can be made through MAPS to support psychedelic parenting. Links to both the MAPS donation page and the GoFundMe can be found in the program notes to this podcast. Today's guest is Brett Green. Brett is the co-founder of Symposia, an organization dedicated to building honest conversations and community around issues of drugs and society through events. By day, he works in administration for an institution known worldwide for their work in advancing the science of cannabinoids and the endocannabinoid system. He is also a musician, composer, entrepreneur, and sort of stepdad to two teenagers. I'm excited to have Brett on today to share some of his personal story, as well as the joys and struggles of being an out psychedelic person in a blended family. Later in the program, we will be joined by Brett's stepson, who will offer his insights into being a teenager today and why he has chosen not to do drugs. Welcome to the show, Brett. Now, you and I have been friends for, I guess, about 2 years now. Is that right?
Yeah, well, Symposia started, this year is going to be our 3-year anniversary, so you were at our first conference.
So 3 years.
Yeah, 3 years.
Wow. It's been a very eventful 3 years in my life, I can say that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So, Brett, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and about Symposia?
Sure. So first, thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
It's been really great to see you come out with psychedelic parenting, which I think is an extraordinarily necessary outlet for our movement in terms of discussing issues related to family and parenting and how that all wraps up with psychedelics. My background is pretty eclectic, I would say. I am a musician. I've been playing and writing songs for over 20 years now. I went to film school and dropped out after my first year. I was the kid in high school that was always trying to challenge the teachers and playing songs that I wrote in the hallways, and, you know, protesting against conformity. I was the kid in the psychedelic shirt, you know, reading Timothy Leary and
right.
And you know, spreading the psychedelic gospel, so to speak, and skipping school and tripping and hiking and the mountains around my town, the hill around my town rather. I was that guy. So really, psychedelics were very profound in my growth. I think of the first time I tripped was at 17, but somehow I ended up reading everything I could get my hands on way before that,
mm-hmm.
and before I had my first experience. So there was something that really drew me to psychedelics, to the whole topic, and I knew that it was going to be a profound subject for me. So, you know, I went to college for filmmaking. I was always very obsessed with movies, sometimes watching up to three or four a day at certain points. And I ended up going to SUNY Purchase and to their Film Conservatory program. And I spent a year there and just hated it. So I dropped out and didn't know what I was going to do at that point. I ended up selling cars, and then somewhere between somewhere around there, I had kind of a psychotic episode. Not really psychotic, but depressive episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hospitalized for what they thought was manic depression, and I went into McLean Hospital, where, you know, James Taylor and Billy Joel have been, and Stephen King, and mm-hmm. You know, good company. And I was there for about 2 weeks to being evaluated, and I ended up coming out on all kinds of meds.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that I would end up, you know, being on disability and essentially just you know, surrendering to this identity of having an illness. And you know, that didn't end up happening. And I think part of the reason that didn't end up happening was because I found ayahuasca. And before I found ayahuasca, I found some other weird things about reality that I discovered that I never was open to.
Mm-hmm.
And I rekindled, let's say, my interest in psychedelics, and also started to see a shaman.
Mm-hmm.
Before long, I took ayahuasca, and my life really changed. I got completely off of medications.
Wow.
I got a job, which I still have, working in a drug discovery lab.
Mm-hmm.
I finished school with a degree in English, and I just started on a different path with, let's say, hues of the psychedelic experience. So that's my background, I guess. Mm-hmm. I work at administration during the day.
Mm-hmm.
We do research that is geared towards the understanding the endocannabinoid system and creating new molecules that in some ways reflect the structures of cannabinoids, the main compounds in cannabis that are explored today for therapeutic value. I've been there 8 years. I founded Symposia 3 years ago after going to Psychedemia in 2012, and then to Horizons in 2013, where I met my partners, and we met Dennis McKenna there, and we said, hey, let's do this event in Massachusetts. And it was this kind of manic fury which wrapped up all of us, and suddenly we had Dennis on board for an event, but we didn't really have anything else. And so we said, hey, we need to get a website, we need to get this and this and this and this. And that one event and the urgency around it grew into us filing as a business, having a website, and really creating a new kind of conference, or what we wanted to see is a new kind of conference, a new kind of community event in the psychedelic world that I am proud to say I feel like we did make, you know, and we're still at it, and we're expanding right now, and I hope someday to be, you know, doing symposia as my primary business.
That's great, dude. Yeah, I think that there's some interesting parallels in sort of the things that you've done and the things that I've done in terms of mixing professional life and this work. And so, I mean, I was a retail drugstore manager for 8 years. So it was right about the same kind of parallel trajectory and stuff. So that's pretty interesting.
I think that mundane work is really great for the imagination, or it can be.
Mm-hmm.
at least for me. Although when it gets really hectic, that's a problem, because it doesn't allow us time to, you know, react.
Right.
Our imaginations.
Exactly. So tell me, one of the things that I think that is really interesting, and it comes up. Nicole and I just got back from doing this really great event in Viroqua, Wisconsin, called the Driftless Psychedelic Symposium. So while we were there, we did a table, and one of the things that comes up a lot when we go around talking to people is how the dynamic of, like, mixed families or couples having children but not being together, how that sort of dynamic influences how comfortable they feel about being, say, open about their use with psychedelics, or expressing it more publicly. So I'm really interested, because you have a dynamic of a mixed home, and I'm really interested in how those things play out in your family life.
Yeah. The issue of being kind of a mixed family, which I can say that I basically have right now, It never really came up, like, in a very obvious kind of way, but, you know, I think at the beginning there was sort of a question as to how I was, like, gonna, like, what role I was gonna play around Jessica's kids.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, because at first I was trying to be kind of a parental figure, trying to, you know, put down discipline and be the idea of the, you know, father figure that I thought I was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't exactly work. so, you know, I had to kind of take a step back, and actually, you know, something really interesting happened. And, you know, one day I was feeling especially hurt because I felt like Jessica's kids really hated me.
Uh-huh.
And I wrote Jessica this text, and I said, you know, I understand that I'm not Timmy's dad, and I really love him, and I just want, you know, the best for him, and I don't want to be his dad. You know, I want to be a friend of his that can help him.
Uh-huh.
And you know, and so it, you know, I want you to talk to Timmy, and if he really doesn't want me in your life, like, I don't, you know, I think I should respect that.
And mm-hmm.
I don't want to be you know, unwanted there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jessica didn't share that with Timmy. I think she basically thought I was just venting. But one time Timmy was, like, scrolling through the messages on her phone while she was driving, and he started to cry, and she turned around and asked, you know, what is it? And he had found my text, and he had read it, and he said, you know, I just never knew that Brett actually understood where I was coming from.
Mm.
And so ever since that, like, our relationship really changed, and it's been great, you know.
Right on.
I think we share this idea that you know, the idea of being a psychedelic person is really more than what substances that we take. It's really about, like, our willingness to go down some deep rabbit holes in terms of, you know, shifting our perception in terms of, you know, overstepping and obliterating in some points different imaginary boundaries that maybe a lot of other people don't see.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah, it's all about it. And I think one of the things this points to, this story, is the importance that I've always stressed of just having this relationship with honesty with people around you. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when you sort of broke through that and the communication was made, it was like all of a sudden there was like this room for something new to flower out of there, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. And you know, I had to resist trying to be an idea, and I had to just be myself.
Of like just trying to be the dad kind of thing?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And yeah, you know, I'm thankful that he found that message, even though he was like snooping around. It's like one of those really cool synchronicities that couldn't really, you know, it's like something that happens in a movie and then I watch it and I said, oh, come on, this is so this is so corny. So contrived,
right,
you know. But no, it's great. I mean, so yeah, having a mixed family is you know, it's not something that really comes up a lot for me, because mm-hmm. you know, I feel like we're, in a sense, like we're all the same age, kind of, and we're all you know, we're all friends, and you know, I think we tend to resist this idea of like these hard and fast roles of parent and child, and I hear a lot on both sides about, you know, the positives and negatives of that. And you know, some people firmly believe that you shouldn't be your child's friend. You should, you know, you should be, you know, an adult figure. And I think that, I mean, you could probably tell what I think of that, but, you know, moderation is really key in everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think parents that really are the poster children for like not being friends with your kids. The ones that, you know, for example, when I was a kid, let me and their son, you know, smoke pot 24/7 in the basement and
right.
drink and do everything else. I mean, that's not, that is like neither being their friend nor their parent.
Amen, brother. Yeah. How do you find that having this sort of pseudo public persona around psychedelics? I mean, I guess we're sort of like, in some ways, like maybe the C-list of psychedelic celebrity, but how do you think that having this public persona, as you know, it is known to among people in your family or like in that extended circle of family that's created by having a mixed family, how does that dynamic play out?
I think it, first of all, it's something I've always been very open about to everybody. Mm-hmm. It never occurred to me to not tell people about my respect for psychedelics and the way that they personally impacted me. And I, you know, it's funny, I can't really count that many times, if any, where that kind of backfired and that people, you know, lashed out at me because of it, or really at least told me that they were not going to talk to me because of that. It probably happened, but, you know, I didn't hear about it. It's always, it feels like just, you know, the same old story, because I've been talking about psychedelics since I was probably 15. So, you know, it's not a persona that I have any trouble with. It doesn't strike me as odd. It's pretty familiar, mm-hmm. and I haven't really known anything else.
As, you know, I think that I feel a lot of ways like the sort of dialogue that's been going on in my head and in Nicole's head about this psychedelic parenting thing. I think that I feel like you've been involved in that conversation kind of from the get-go with me, and I've appreciated that. And how does that work out in terms of having, you know, kids that are around you that aren't your kids, and how does the dynamic play out in the decisions you make regarding how to, you know, be open with them about these things?
Both of my kids have asked me about drugs. Mm-hmm. Both of them have suggested that, you know, the topic of psychedelics is interesting to them. And I think it's interesting because they know about it through me, and I'm very passionate about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also, they don't really have that much of an urge to do drugs. And, I think that is partially because they know that, you know, I smoke pot, and they don't really, it's not something that's cool to them, maybe because
right.
of that,
right.
because I'm not cool
that.
To them.
Right? Yes.
And, they also just don't really think that getting high in and of itself is cool. And I think that's something I'm grateful for, because when I was their age, I went through this phase where all my friends were getting high, and getting high for the sake of getting high was really cool. And it became kind of a lifestyle choice, and I feel like it ate up a lot of my time.
Uh-huh.
And insofar as I regret anything, I sort of regret all the time that I wasted just getting stoned. Now my Timmy came to me one day, and he said, "Do you think I should smoke pot?" And I said, "No, probably not. You should probably wait." And he goes, "Well, why? Did you wait?" And I said, "Well, no, I didn't. But I feel like I wasted a lot of time." And he goes, "Well, is it bad for me?" And I said, "Well, I mean, that kind of remains to be seen. Like, some studies say that it is bad for children. Other studies seem to be less, conclusive."
Yeah,
but
science
is
still up in the air, I think.
Yeah, but I said that, you know, what I think was certain for me is that it quickly went from, like, something that I did to, get, like, a positive effect from, to just something that I did out of habit.
Uh-huh.
I got from just hanging out with people. And that's when it goes from being healthy for me to being something that is really habitual and masks a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And I think that with drug use in general, there's a thin line between helpful and escapist.
Yeah.
And, when I talk to people about drugs, 9 out of 10 of them who are kind of naive about the subject will say, "Well, is this good or is this bad?" And I think to myself, well, like, if you're in a sauna, drinking a cup of coffee is probably really bad.
Uh-huh.
But if you're, waking up, drinking a cup of coffee is probably just what you need.
Yeah.
And we need to start looking at food and substances and really anything that we have a relationship with in less of a, let's face it, like, Judeo-Christian, this is good, this is bad way.
Yeah.
And more in why am I doing this now way.
Sure.
And, what is the context here?
Yep.
And I really think that, my experience with drugs speak to that, especially because, for example, when it comes to marijuana, there are some times when the same strain of marijuana will make me really anxious. And then there are times where the same strain of marijuana will make me very serene, will make me very energized. And I find that if I really listen to my body, I can feel when it's going to be a good idea to use cannabis and when it's not.
Uh-huh.
And, so that's just an aside. But
yeah.
Basically then, after we had this discussion about marijuana, Timmy said, "Well, what about mushrooms?" And I had to hesitate. And I said, "Well, that comes down to setting the setting."
Right.
Because even though it's pretty taboo, and I think you share this opinion, I think that the psychedelic experience can be just what an eighth grader might need in a different kind of society. But we don't have the desire or whatever to, really envision that as a culture.
This is something that's really been stewing in my mind lately, and I think this, I keep coming back over and over again to this question of how old is old enough. And I more and more believe that what makes, it acceptable or like okay, in another culture that maybe we need to be careful about is this idea of a cultural container for the experience. Like, if we can work together to construct viable cultural containers so that when people come out of these experiences, even as young people, that they have a community of support and that they have a way for like the visions that they get to become a part of their life or integrated into the community. And I think that's the thing that we really lack, and why I feel like more reserved about, or more conservative about the like how old is old enough kind of thing. Because we don't have those containers.
Sure.
And I hopefully, my hope is that this podcast and this work will be a part of this sort of, setting up the framework or like building conversation at least around what those containers should look like.
Sure, and I also would go so far as to say that we live in a capitalist society, and because of that, in a way, those containers are pretty hard to establish. And obviously that's a very involved statement that I haven't really quantified very well, but suffice to say, the let's say that the psychedelic experience can in many ways resemble the mirror opposite of values from those which are encouraged by our society. So because those values run counter to our society, it's very dangerous actually to take a child who has to on some level conform to those and give them an experience which instills in them opposite values.
I agree.
It's kind of a sad but true thing. I think that that adults, meanwhile, the psychedelic experience can be very beneficial in reminding the adult of kind of the greater values, and those values can then be integrated in day-to-day interaction with the, let's say, the oppositional values. One of the things that we don't really like to talk about is how, because of the way that the cage is designed, the rats have different ways to move around. If there's a roof on the cage, you can't fly out of the cage, you know? So the way that our society is designed certainly has impacts on our behavior, and I think that the psychedelic experience can, in a sense, really just pop all the walls off the cage temporarily. And for an adult, like there's a way that experience can be integrated in terms of being able to now navigate society from like kind of a clearer place. But for a child, like it can really be in a sense emphasizing the prison, and you don't want to do that for a child. Like you want to, because really, you say you want a revolution. We all want to change the head. You asked me for a revolution, but you better free your mind instead. I think that's part of the issue here.
One of the things that that your description I was thinking of while you were talking is in the movie, I haven't read the books, the Divergent series, but there's this whole thing of like people have these like entheogenic experiences. They like go to this place and they get this injection when they are going to decide like what guild they're going to join as they become adults, and then they have to go through this like challenge at the end of their training to like sort of be full members, and they have to have a go through another psychedelic experience where they're put through this like sort of gauntlet of decisions. And the main character, so her, she's a divergent because she doesn't sort of fit into one of these sort of social blocks very well. She's like has the qualities of all of them. So when she goes into these sort of psychedelic tests places, she's able to like I guess you'd say see that there's no top on the cage and sort of jump out and like fix the problem by essentially like short circuiting the illusion. And so when like this other guy who's like one of her mentors notices that she can do this, and he basically tells her like, yeah, I see that you sort of solved the puzzle, but that you can't do it that way, because when you go in front of these people who are going to test you, they'll know that you're doing it this opposite way, and they'll know who you are. And I think that speaks to the psychedelic experience in an interesting way.
Yeah, there's concealment that's kind of inevitable.
Yeah.
And usually the concealment sort of happens by our own volition, because we want things, you know? Like, right. Any of us can you know, sell all our belongings and, you know, go and you know, start a one-man commune or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We've chosen not to do that. And
right.
So, you know, that choice requires that we really wear two hats.
Yep.
So psychedelic people, I think, in this culture are left with this dialectic of constantly comparing these two value systems.
Yes. Yep. So later on, we're going to have Timmy come in and share it. But before we get to that, I do want to ask you about something that I learned a relatively recent time ago, and I think that it would be an interesting story to share. You and Jessica had a son together a couple of years ago.
That was in, I believe that was January of 2013.
Okay, yeah, so yeah. Right before I met you.
January 20th.
Okay, yeah.
2013. Yeah, so.
I'm interested in hearing about that experience and how it, you know, changed you as a human being.
Well, Jessica and I were, just in brief, we met in a support group for people with bipolar. And so our relationship kind of started where all of our shit was on the table already. And so we've had this very open relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's really the opposite of like the slow seduction and then the you know, marriage of hell. we had this semi-tumultuous relationship. Really, like, what would happen is we would have, you know, multiple years of really just happiness, and then they would all just suddenly erupt seemingly out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. That happened with Jessica and I 1 year, and then ironically it was the year that I would go to psychedemia and really get back into the whole psychedelic sphere, and she and I just kind of all of a sudden broke up. And you know, one day, like, my brother came up with a truck, and you know, I got all my shit out and I moved, and then we basically stopped talking. And when I went to one of the psychedelics conferences in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
Psychedemia, I had this revelation about things that I had done wrong in our relationship that I had never apologized for. It was things that I had kept from her. Mm. And, you know, she was always going to be like this person that I was completely honest with. You know, even if I wasn't honest with myself or anyone else, I would be honest with her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I occasioned to call her and kind of reconnect while I was here, and you know, apologize. And so we started talking again. That was after like a 6 month break, and
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, kind of a month passed, and I called her again to see how she was doing, And I told her about how great my life was and how everything was going so well. And, you know, she basically was like, well, so, you know, so I guess you're happy without me then. And I think I said, my answer basically implied the affirmative. And it was that point that she let me have it, that she was pregnant.
Wow.
And so that I'll never forget, like, the minute that I found out she was pregnant, it was like the whole world stopped, and you know, all the blood drained out of my face, and it's like the worst thing I'd ever heard. And you know, and then she, not only that, but she, like, she was just like, yeah, and I, we don't need you. And then she hung up and wouldn't answer my calls. And so, I mean, she was very hurt, obviously. And so basically I started talking to her sister, and, you know, the same night, and tried to figure things out. And kind of in stereotypical fashion, we ended up getting back together. You know, for the sake of having a kid together. And we had very different ideas on how we wanted to raise this kid. And it, you know, he came out of nowhere, and like I said, it went from us being broken up to us suddenly like, okay, let's get back together. It's been a year, but whatever. And oh, not quite a year. But so, you know, that's what happened. And oh, I ended up moving back and moving in with her, and, you know, really trying to be like the good guy, the breadwinner, everything, to be a father. But the more I tried, the more our relationship just became like this obligatory kind of thing, where it just felt like all the passion had been distilled out of it. And you know, I started taking her to her medical appointments. She was a high-risk pregnancy anyway because of the meds that she's on for bipolar. And so there were complications kind of all the way through her pregnancy. And we started near the end of it going to this hospital, and she was bleeding a lot. And so we would go, and they would basically say, oh, this is normal. And she would say, no, no, it's not. And finally she miscarried at home, and actually she gave birth at home, and the ambulance came, but you know, Freddie, that's what we ended up calling him, his lungs weren't developed enough. And but, and it took us a long time to face this. It ended kind of it was okay, you know, we were okay with what happened. It was really like a roller coaster of a year. And when, you know, when that happened, we ended up breaking up shortly thereafter. And somehow a year later, we realized that we couldn't live with each other without each other. And we got back together, and I don't think we would have gotten back together if it wasn't for Freddie. You know, it's still very complicated, but yeah, you know, I feel like, things happen in life that, you know, it's just, that's the fact, things happen. And, we tend to look at things like that as purely like tragic, but I guess I see it, I look back on it more like you know, like a Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel or something. There's like a magic realism aspect to it. And that's really how I see my life is and again, I mean, that also goes back to psychedelics, you know, because the trip encompasses the terror and, you know, the beauty, and, you know, to fathom hell or soar angelic, right? And so having that approach to life, I think, is something I've always had. Like, there is like an order to things within the chaos. Mm-hmm. And I really feel like things like that event especially kind of tapped me into that. And you know, I'm grateful for it, and Jessica's grateful for it, and you know, we really I think we owe what we have to Freddie.
Mm. Wow. One of the things that ayahuasca has made me realize that we humans are, we're meaning-making machines. Every experience that we have, you as a human being, you either have to like incorporate it and transcend it or be destroyed by it. Mm. And that's like, in some ways, that's like, is intertwined with our own sort of like biological evolution even. I mean, you know, the reason why people see faces in the geometric chaos in a psychedelic experience is because our brains are wired to see faces and recognize faces.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that like, we're just like wired to find meaning and to like, so finding meaning in the things that, you know, that could destroy us. There's that whole thing, what doesn't destroy me makes me stronger, right? So it's pretty cliche, I guess. But I think that that really is like at the heart of how we're evolving as a species.
Mm.
Is how do we make, like, find meaning and like find connection through, you know, the inevitable suffering of the material world.
Mm. I think that that's true of the past, and that's uh-huh. true of where we're coming out of.
Uh-huh.
But I like to think that where we're going to is a reckoning with the whole idea of meaning itself.
Mm-hmm.
Where meaning becomes implicit in the whole, not in the parts.
Hmm. What does that look like?
Well, I think it looks like putting language in its place, living not at the behest of our language, mm-hmm. but living through our language. Right now, I feel like we live with a gun to our head, and the gun is like our preconceptions, our beliefs, our language. Uh-huh. And we're out there trying to acquire more things, yeah. using that language. Mm-hmm. So it's like perpetuating itself.
Yeah.
Where our linguistic structures are really influencing our decisions and how we act. And I think that what we need to be doing is starting with our values, and I think those values are less about what traditionally we would call meaning, and they're more about almost the rules that we decide on for like a game. Mm-hmm. We realize ultimately that they're malleable. Mm-hmm. But we consciously decide to use them for a logical reason. So it's like the difference between being a victim of our rationalization and being the chiefs of our rationalization. Mm-hmm. You know, until we do away with language. And obviously, you know, this was part of Terence's message as well, which is you know, the culture is not our friend, and that, right. and that language on some level entraps us.
Right.
And, you know, throughout the ages, there have been, you know, countless attempts to synthesize language with, let's say, non-language, spirit and matter, to, you know, to end the dialectic for once and for all, you know, to do away with the thesis and the antithesis. You know, Plato, Nietzsche said that Jesus was Plato for the masses, because Jesus was like the union of the word and the flesh, you know, the coming together of it. But I think that this whole attempt that we're continually trying to make of reconciling, you know, the word with what it symbolizes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the reason why we can't do it permanently is because doing it itself requires like a state of being, and that state of being is this heightened state of being.
I would agree with that.
Everything in our society makes that state of being run counter to what we need to do to survive.
Right.
So, you know, until we change, like, let's say, the requirements of cultural survival, we shouldn't expect that we're going to be able to end the dialectic, you know, anytime soon.
Yeah. And I do believe that one of the things, I came from a tradition of, you know, steeped in, like, sort of in the Hindu Vedic yoga tradition. And one of the things that I've sort of come away with now is this idea that, you know, I guess I would say that I'm cynical about the existence of what the sages call enlightenment. That, like, there's moments where the ego goes away, and you can be in those moments and see what's sort of behind the curtain, but you can't really come back into the world and do anything unless you put the ego back on. Like, you know, Paramahansa Yogananda called the ego this overstuffed coat that he, you know, would go indoors and feel hot and stuffy and like he couldn't do anything in it. And I think that, like, I think of it as like a tool. It's like if you want to make change in the physical world, you have to have an ego through which to do it. So the idea that there's a state where there is no ego, I'm not sure if it like would even serve a purpose.
I agree with you, but I think that the problem isn't. I think the ego is actually like this scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when I will be having a psychedelic experience where the ego that I generate, let's say, is the cosmic identity.
Mm-hmm.
Much like the protagonist of Whitman's Song of Myself. You know, and that is a persona.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the persona of the collective. Mm-hmm. And that's different than like the Buddhist idea of just pure emptiness, right?
Yeah.
The idea of a persona as like representation of the cosmic, you know, of the macro.
Yeah.
I think that ego, in so far as it's an ego, is not at all antithetical to what we should be developing.
Yeah.
And so when people talk about, you know, ego death, I think that oftentimes it's a misnomer.
Yeah.
And when it's not a misnomer, it's, in a way, it's kind of overrated. You know, if nobody's gonna identify with Mother Earth, then the planet's gonna continue to die. If nobody's gonna identify with the starving child, he's gonna continue to starve.
Right.
In a way, compassion, in my opinion, requires some kind of personification.
Right. Yes.
And that, you know, the act of personification, in my opinion, isn't the problem. So ego death isn't the solution. But at the same time, you know, the idea of ego death suggests stepping over boundaries, expanding, mm-hmm.
Sure.
Changing, being able to escape from you know, the gun at the back of the head that is,
yeah,
our concepts.
Temporary ego death is necessary and useful, I think.
Well, you know, I really like the model that Alex Belser and the NYU guys have set up, which
uh-huh.
which looks at the ego rigidity and ego-lysis, I believe, or egolytic
mm-hmm.
Range spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a schizophrenic doesn't really need more ego loss. If anything,
right.
If anything, they could use some more ego rigidity.
Right, right.
So, in, you know, that model there is kind of a good pointer at sort of maybe looking at who can really benefit from psychedelics. But other than that, looking at maybe how we can sort of view the psychedelic experience in the context of, you know, where it's going to be a positive development. So yeah, I like that model, and I really don't think that ego death is much of a permanent solution for anybody.
Right on.
Actually, so Timmy just stopped by.
Right on. Hi, Timmy.
Yeah.
What's up?
Nothing much.
How's it going, man?
Good.
Good. Hey, so Brett tells me that you have a story to share.
I was on the bus, and I guess we were talking about something, and we got to the subject of psychedelics, and they're like, wait, what is psychedelics? So I decided to explain a bit more, like, what I knew at the time.
Uh-huh.
Because Brett was just starting to introduce me to the world of psychedelics, so...
Well, the ideas, not the actual substances.
The concepts, yeah.
Let's be clear.
And so were you? What was the outcome? How did that conversation go?
Well, I guess I found it kind of interesting, but, you know, people in middle school, they just act like idiots, so I guess they...
You shouldn't be surprised about that.
Walked away and went somewhere else.
What do you think it's like having me in the house?
Well, it's definitely more interesting. It's I actually have something to do besides staying in my room and dying.
Playing video games.
Well, unfortunately, I can't stop the dying process, but I'm working on it.
But you're not all the way through puberty yet, so technically you're not dying. You're not in the dying process yet. You've got a couple more years.
Yeah. Has any kids your age told you about taking drugs?
Not really, because I guess people just don't, like, you know, aren't in the whole drug thing at my school. They're not that interested in it. I'm pretty sure one kid did, like, marijuana or something.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all I heard.
Do you think if you wanted to find it at school, you'd know where to look?
No.
Huh. See, that's quite different from my school, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Because I was the one in my school.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that when I didn't really get interested in psychedelics until I was in college, but, you know, there were people in my high school, certainly, that, you know, there were the kids that took acid at school, and so, you know, but I don't know if I knew anybody in middle school who was using, like, I knew people that smoked pot in middle school. I smoked pot in middle school, but not other stuff, really. A lot of drinking. I went to a very rural school, so there wasn't a lot to do once you got into high school. I guess one thing that I would like to ask Timmy is, what does your school teach you when it comes to different substances? And
actually, recently we have a health and gym class, and we were doing half of it health and half of it was gym. And we watched a video on how substances could possibly kill you. Like, what was it? When you
inhalants.
Yeah, inhalants.
Oh, okay.
We watched a video about inhalants, and I guess it's not no anymore. They're kind of like scaring you into not doing drugs.
Well, that's the same as it was for us. Yeah. Are inhalants something that people do on a regular basis?
See, I was kind of mad that they even showed them that video, because if there's one substance that I never want him to touch, it's like anything that comes from like rubber cement or
something that he's inhaling.
So I didn't even want them to know about it. One day I heard sound of a whipped cream canister being emptied, And so I, you know, leapt off the bed and came outside, and Timmy's sitting there with his friend, and his friend is like pouring it in his mouth. And I said, "Huh, what are you doing?" And he's like, "Oh, I'm just eating whipped cream." And I looked at him, and it was obvious that he was just eating whipped cream. So I said, "Oh, okay, all right." And he goes, "Why?" And I said, "Oh, no reason. I just
don't worry about it.
Was curious." there are drugs that they could get that they should have some guidance about.
Right.
You know, but telling them about how they could get high by inhaling something in the kitchen is probably not very good, like, proactive education.
Right. right.
You know, I could see if they ended up, like, finding out there was a big problem with inhalants that they decided to dedicate some time to it. But, you know, otherwise it's probably putting something in their heads that they don't need exposure to. Can I ask Timmy a few more questions?
Yeah, definitely you should.
So, Timmy, what did you first think when you found out what I was interested in?
Well, I also found it very interesting how you knew so much about it, so you could put it in so much detail, and I just found it really more interesting. When you're talking, it's like learning that catches me for some reason. It's something that I find that it's worth actually learning about.
Did it make you want to try it?
No, it didn't make me want, like, you talking about it didn't make me want to try it. I just wanted to actually learn about what's going on, like, going around in our world, like, what people could be doing and what the effects could happen to them, and it sounds interesting.
So where do you stand on the issue of drugs being illegal?
I don't really have an opinion. Like, it could be illegal or legal, but either way, people are still going to be doing them, so
yep,
there's going to be no way of stopping it. It's already in our world.
If you could design a health class that was about drugs for your class, what would it be like?
Definitely, like, putting, like, telling people that there's more than just weed and stuff, like, different kind of drugs, like, what's more dangerous and what's less dangerous, like, what people start out with, what, like, a bunch, like, people, like, things you should watch out for, like, basically what's going around and what's very, like, normal and what's very, like, uncommon.
Mm.
That's probably what it would be about.
And at this point, if somebody came to you at school and they said, "Hey, Timmy, I've got mushrooms, I've got acid, like, do you want to have some?" Like, what would your reaction be?
I'd be like, "You can do it by yourself. I'd rather not. I'd rather actually be smart. I'd rather not be an idiot."
And why is that?
Because they can do it if they want. That's their life. I'll do what I want, and I'll make my own choices. And I find that I don't need to do drugs at school because it's unnecessary.
Oh, what about if they said, "Hey, I want you to come to my farmhouse, 10 miles away, and my parents can pick you up, and we're gonna take mushrooms."
I wouldn't. It's still like somebody that from my school, I would say no, because, you know, what if they just got this all from a friend and they have no idea what's going to happen? And you never know what's going to happen. They could have accidentally, like, you know, gave you, like, horse tranquilizers or something. And, you know, it just is like, you can't just go blindly and follow some idiot's, like, description of drugs.
Why do you think so many people do?
Because they want, like, their social classes, and they want to be popular. And if they want to, like, you know, if they think that drugs are going to help them be more popular, then they'll probably do it if it's, like, a popular kid. Or they're just, like, interest. Like, they're like, whoa, I wonder what's going to happen. Am I going to really, like, trip and stuff? And it's like, yeah.
Who do you think is considered the expert on drugs in your school?
I'm not sure at all.
I just don't think it's cool at their school,
right?
You know, I so what is cool? What's trendy right now? Video games?
I don't know, because I could honestly care less. Like, I'm not trying to be popular. I'm trying to be myself.
Good thing. Yeah. Ultimately, the people that are true to themselves are the ones that are going to end up happy. The people that are constantly courting popularity or finding looking for the definition of yourself in other people's opinions is in some ways a particular definition of mental illness itself. So good for you.
Yay.
Timmy, other kids at your school that drink alcohol?
Do any kids? You know, not people that I know that, like, openly say it, but, you know, there probably is, like, a kid that drinks alcohol at our school.
Did you ever drink alcohol, Timmy?
I definitely can't say no. I did try it, I guess, but, like, only a sip. I didn't like it.
Was it a sip?
It was a couple of years ago, so I don't know.
That was very insightful. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So let's just do a little wrap up
where
we talk maybe about upcoming symposia events, if you have any in the works, and maybe what your longer term vision for the organization is.
So yeah, with respect to events up in the works, there's one on, I believe, a psychedelic stories event or psychoactive stories that's happening at the Women's Visionary Conference that we're really excited about. We're in talks to do a caravan tour with SSDP and DPA. We're doing less conferences and more like spread out events.
So
there's just a lot in development right now. Sorry, I can't be more concrete about it. But definitely, I hope your audience checks out the symposia website regularly. We also have a magazine that's getting launched. I think the first issue should be coming out by March.
Exciting!
That's awesome. Yeah. So it's pretty cool. And
so, I would want to just thank Brett, you for being here today for this talk, and for Timmy coming on and giving some insights. It's cool to see the dynamic, and it'll be interesting to, you know, keep reporting back in a couple of years and see how you think things change. And it's interesting to have someone to kind of see how things are different from when I was a kid. This has been a wonderful conversation, my friends.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
All right.
All right, you take care.
Bye.